Welcome to the Logic Consortium. Today on the show, we're speaking with Professor Olivier Roy, famous for his work, The Failure of Political Islam, written in 1995, talking about really the roots of radical Islamist movements and how their ideologies have sometimes failed in some areas. And so we talked to him about his book and different Islamist movements and ways that maybe forward. So thanks so much to Professor Roy for joining us, and please stick around. I first wanted to talk about the roots of certain types of Islamist movements, and how you've mentioned that these roots are not so much in the Middle East, but in young cohorts of people who've been alienated by their own society.
We can see that the huge majority of people who go to terrorism or to radical violence in the West are Western educated, you know. Some of them, and a significant number of them, are in fact also converts, which means that their radicalization has no roots or no direct roots in the Middle East, but has more to do with their own trajectory, their own life in the West. And many of them, especially the convert, of course, join Islam not so much for purely religious reasons, but because they find in Islam a cause to fight for, or more exactly, a narrative of the opposition to Western culture, or at least to the Western political system. So the process of radicalization among Islamic radicals in the West is not so much a direct importation from the Middle East than an local, indigenous, you know, Western process of radicalization.
And you talk about how the most fertile ground for radicals are the young generations.
Yeah, and for a good reason, or a bad reason, of course, if we can speak like that. But their religion is not embedded into a real culture, you know. For their parents, for the first generation, religion and culture are, I would say, almost the same thing. So they have a non-radical attitude towards religion. Religion is part of the everyday life. It's not an ideology. It's not something which is isolated from social life. But for the born again and for the converts, religion is something which has to be separated from the surrounding culture, you know. So they have some sort of specific attitude towards religion. They isolate religion from culture and social life. And this, of course, leads to have a more fanatical approach to religion, or I would say just a more political perception of what religion is.
And as you kind of just mentioned, one of the themes is that these movements are thoroughly modern, in that they are responding to modern conditions and have nothing to do with traditional Islam.
Yeah, they may borrow some terms, you know, like jihad from traditional Islam. But the kind of violence they use is, in fact, in the anarchist tradition, in the Western anarchist tradition, the first guys who threw bombs, you know, on civilians were French anarchists of the last 20th century. So this tradition of throwing bombs, of individual terrorism, and I would say of also the mystical approach of the terrorists, you know, as somebody who can redeem himself and change the world by his personal action, is a typical product of the Western history of political terrorism since the late 19th century. So it's typically modern. The perception they have of a global power dominating the world societies, the use they make of terms like imperialism, Western domination, and all that is also, you know, in the tradition of the Western ultra-left, and specifically the European ultra-left and communist movements, like the Red Brigades in Italy during the 70s, or the Bader Group in Germany during the 70s. So the roots of their violence, and I would say the patterns of their radical violence, is rooted in Western history and not in traditional Muslim history.
So in your book, The Failure of Political Islam, you mentioned how there was really this failure of this political movement to take hold as kind of a rallying call for the whole Muslim community in the world. Could you talk about this a little bit?
My book on the failure of political Islam was written 15 years ago, you know. I stick to my point. Look at what is going on in Iran. In Iran, the idea of the Islamic revolution was to establish a new kind of society, a new kind of social justice, a new kind of institutions, constitution, government, and so on and so. And the idea was that such an Islamic state would fulfill the wishes of the population and be a beacon, a model for the other Muslim countries. And what do we have now? In Iran, we have a very, of course, disgruntled society. We have some sort of democracy, by the way, which means that the population is politically aware, goes to the streets, goes to the police stations when there are elections. And Iran is probably the most secular society now in the Muslim world, after 30 years of Islamic government. So the Islamic model is a failure. The economy is in very bad shape. There is no real democracy, of course. There is a lot of corruption at the highest level of the state. There is no social justice and no justice at all, if I can say that. But nevertheless, the Iranian society, to a certain extent, has been modernized, you know, during this Islamic government. We have more and more women in the labor market. The majority of the students are, in fact, women. The fertility rate has fallen, you know, to almost the same level than the French fertility rate, for instance. So, in fact, an Islamic revolution brought something which has little or nothing to do with the idea of a pure Islamic society.
Can you talk a little bit more about how political power and Sharia law, Islamic law, are playing out now in Iran?
The same way. In fact, what is working in Iran is power, you know, not Sharia. Every time there could be some sort of a contradiction between the legal concept of Sharia, the Islamic law, and sheer political power, it's the political power which, of course, makes a point, you know, and has the last say. And in fact, what we see now is that more and more conservative clerics are upset, you know, by this authoritarian government, which has lost its religious legitimacy. Of course, if you look as far as, for instance, laws on inheritance are concerned, you find some Sharia. But it's confined to the private law, to family law. And it has nothing to do with the system. For instance, an Islamic judge cannot oppose the regime by saying that this or that political decision has not been done according to Sharia. So the people who are deciding now about Sharia are secular dictators, if I can say that, you know, which is illustrated by the fact that apart the guide, Ayatollah, or so-called Ayatollah Khamenei, the power now is in the hands of the Revolutionary Guards, which are lay people and absolutely not religious clerics.
And sometimes in the West, there's this visceral reaction to this idea of Sharia law. But there's nothing wrong with this idea per se, would be my contention, but rather how it's implemented and the details.
You know, Sharia law has never been a state law. By that, I mean that the people who decide or try to decide what Sharia is are the judges. So it's a law of jurisprudence. It's not a law, a codified law. So in fact, I would say Sharia is never a state of things. Sharia is always a project, you know, which depends on the practices of the judges and, of course, on the local environment. So it's very difficult to define in an objective manner what Sharia is or should be. And there is a huge space for interpretation, and you can have liberal or conservative or fundamentalist interpretation of Sharia. So Sharia is the idea that there is a law, that there are norms, and that these norms don't depend on any political power. But that said, it's very open, you know. And every time a regime or a government has tried to transform Sharia from a jurisprudential system to a state law, it failed. It failed just because the people, the politicians, the political leaders, they never had any intention to give a free hand to the judges for interpretation. Most of the, we say all the regimes who which claim, you know, to implement Sharia are authoritarian regimes, which means that they do not accept a space for interpretation and debate. So, in fact, they are opposed to something which is at the core of the legal practice of Sharia, interpreting and decided, you know, on a case by case basis.
Getting back to the book, I heard in a kind of a recent interview, you said that the failure of the political movement of Islam has led to two things. One is the Muslim equivalent of a Christian Democratic Party who valued democracy and pluralism. And the second is neo-fundamentalist movements who don't recognize pluralism and don't want to compromise. Can you talk about this a little bit?
Yeah, it's the two extreme positions, you know, that we can find, or that I find, once the idea of the failure of political Islam is accepted. Christian democracy, it's, for instance, the AK party in Turkey. It's a liberal party in terms of economy. It's a conservative party in terms of values and norms. And it's a parliamentarian party, a party which accepts the concept of elections and political alternance. So, and this party, the AK party, is, I would say, quite happy to be compared, you know, with the modern Western conservative parties. And they prefer to use the term conservative than to use the term religious. So we have this possibility, you know. And many Muslim brothers in Egypt, in Jordan, in Kuwait, in the Emirates, and in Tunisia, by the way, and to a certain extent in Morocco, are going or would like, you know, to follow this path. But of course, to let them follow this path, there should be a democratic political system, which is not the case, except in Turkey. And the second, you know, extreme, if I can say that, reaction to the failure of political Islam is neo-fundamentalists. The neo-fundamentalists, or for instance, the Wahhabis, the Salafis, are people who think that you cannot establish a good Islamic political system if the people have not been born again in the meantime. So the idea is that we should first build a strong faith community of true believers, you know, that may or may not transform themselves into a political society. But as long as there is no an individual, you know, returns to the true tenets of the religion, or at least the true tenets as they see them, of course, then there could not be an Islamic society. And this trend, you know, to replace or to put as an alternative to political societies the concept of pure faith communities made of born-again people, it's not, by the way, particular to the Muslims. We can find that among Protestants and among some ultra-Orthodox Jews, by the way. So these neo-fundamentalists are both, of course, very radical in their religious ideas, but these religious ideas do not necessarily translate into a political agenda. You know, they may, like the Taliban in Afghanistan, or they may not, you know, like this Salafi faith community that we have in Western Europe, for instance, of people just, you know, trying to live at the margins of the society without integrating in it.
Staying on the neo-fundamentalist note, I heard you mention somewhere that bin Laden is really an extremist form of this neo-fundamentalism. But he kind of carries on some of the things that you just mentioned in that there's no model for governance that he's offering, only stated mission to destroy the West. And can you talk about that a little bit?
It's true that bin Laden may saw a fish, if I can say that, you know, in the neo-fundamentalist pound, and he may find some supporters there. But in itself, if we look at what bin Laden did, is doing, and is saying, there is very little religion in it. Yeah. His discourses are mainly political declarations about Western imperialism, about the suffering of the Muslim and so. But there are some interesting things. He almost never mentioned the Sharia. Yeah. He never mentioned what should be an Islamic society or an Islamic state. He doesn't care about that. His narrative is a purely militant narrative. of, I would say, a bunch of heroes who fight the big power, which is, of course, the USA. His narrative is, as I said, is more based on some sort, you know, the concept of an revolutionary vanguard of a small number of militants, individual militants, who by their deeds and their ability to organize are able to shake up the world order. But there is no blueprint for a society. And it's interesting to see that, for example, there is a very religious training, you know, in Ben Laden camps. Contrary to what many people think, the Ben Laden training bases are not madrasa, are not religious schools, you know. And there is no training on Quran or theology and things like that. They're not interested in that. Ben Laden, he's, I would say, a double edge. On one hand, he's a neo-fundamentalist, you know, which who doesn't believe, you know, in establishing an Islamic society now, because the Muslim societies are too perverted by Westernization. But on the other hand, he doesn't care too much about religion. He doesn't care about Sharia. And he's closer, as I said, you know, to the model of the lonely Western revolutionary who does propaganda by the deed.
I heard you say on Charlie Rose a few years back in an interview that to resolve some of these problems, you must allow for there to be a home for Islam in the West. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I think that, you know, Islam, of course, came recently in the West and through the migration, you know, a demographic migration, on an individual basis, which is something which is very new in history. You know, we have very little experience of that. So for the first generation of Muslims in the West, Islam is linked with the traditional culture of the countries of origin. So Islam is both a religion and a culture. But for the new generations and for the converts, and among the converts, for instance, we have now a lot of African-American, for instance. For them, Islam is a religion. And I would say Islam is just a religion. They are not interested in speaking Arabic, you know, in their everyday life. They are not interested to dress, you know, with traditional Arabic gown. They are not interested to the life of traditional Arabic society. So they have, in fact, I would say, a Western conception of religion, a practice, a faith, which is first individual, and then is practiced in the framework of a faith community and not of a society. So what we see is, I would say, the formatting of Islam as a religion, as just a religion, if I can say that, in the West. And, of course, the paradigm of religious freedom and of what a religion is or should be. So what we see, for instance, the mosques are more and more looking like any kind of congregation, religious congregation, you know, with social activities, Boy Scouts. So we have now a Muslim Boy Scout in America, which is something which didn't make sense in traditional Muslim societies. We have a Muslim social life, which is a social life of a community and not of a society. So we can see how the majority of the Muslims in the West are in fact, you know, reshaping their faith into a Western paradigm of what a religion is. But of course, this process is not easy. And, you know, you have, it doesn't always work. So at the margins, you have people who are not happy about this disconnect between religion and culture. You have a process of political radicalization. You may have also some kind of schizophrenia, you know, people who are totally cut between two personalities, the religious personality and their social life, you know, and so and so. But if we look, you know, in terms of, long-term, by long-term I mean a generation changes, we can see that now modern mosque in the suburb of an American town has little to do with a mosque in the suburbs of Cairo, for instance, or of Jeddah in Saudi Arabia.
And kind of just wrapping up, I know that in the last few years you spent time in California teaching at Berkeley.
Yeah.
And could you give an overall comment on the American political rhetoric talking about, or just the rhetoric among people talking about this, these issues, and what you noticed?
I've been struck by one fact in Berkeley, but it's maybe specific to California. Islam has little to do with the Middle East, you know. For instance, the Israelo-Palestinian conflict is not debated among Muslim students speaking about what does it mean to be a Muslim in the USA. Of course, most of the Muslims are from Asia, South Asia in particular. There are many converts among them. Many of them are second generations, so they do not have a direct experience. But I've been struck by the fact that the Muslim community, the second and third generation, are far less politicized than the first generation. And they are far more interested in building a Muslim faith community, which can, I would say, compete, but in the positive sense of the term of competing, with the other American faith communities. So we have an endeavor to reshape, you know, to reformat Islam from a culture to a religion. And of course, this trend is very strong among students, among the majority of the students. And I've been struck by the importance, for instance, of the interfaith dialogue, of the endeavor to join, for instance, Christian theological seminaries, joint united seminaries, for instance, which had been established by different Christian denominations. And in Berkeley, for instance, the Muslims did join, you know, the young Muslim students did join, you know, the joint theological seminary, for instance. And the debate about faith, about religion, about norms, religious norms in the public sphere, for instance. But not or little about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict of the Iraq war.
And thanks so much to Professor Olivier Roy for that interview. And that's it for today's Logic Consortium.